but it's not the seven. And the chief is committed to working with us and the community to get this right. I'm very happy to vote aye. The amendment's adopted. So colleagues, that leaves us with one last vote on this particular piece of the budget, and that is to vote for the budget as amended. And so with that, at this point, we will now vote to adopt the budget as amended. Any further discussion before we do so? Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
I want to start by thanking the young people who have taken to the street every night for over 2 weeks. I want to thank you for elevating this conversation to the point where there was no doubt that we would act. I want you to know that though we have heard over and over again that the request was for a reduction of $50 million from the police budget, I will tell you that the actions that we are taking today will make sure that we have reduced the police budget by $27 million. That is significant, and I am absolutely, I know for sure that that would have never happened without you taking to the street. I want you to know that ever since we started this conversation, my colleagues and I have been in deep conversation about where we can go. I also want to assure the community that the passing of budget is not the end of reform in the Portland Police Bureau. I have publicly said to Chief Lavelle, I will be there to help him make the reform that the community has demand. It is important that as we move forward, that we keep our eye on the prize. For many years, I have believed that the only way for us to have community police officers is for community to be able to train our community police officers side by side with police officers. And so I will be working with the chief to totally revise how we recruit, how we train.
Thank you, commissioners. Thank you, city council, for bringing us that stream so that we, KBOO Portland, could bring it to you, the listener. Now we're going to continue fulfilling our obligation to the community with our regularly scheduled evening newscast. Stay tuned.
Number of cases today as Multnomah County plans to get ready for stage one reopening. KBOO's Annette Newell has these stories and more with this local COVID-19 update.
The United States hit a grim milestone today. Our country has surpassed 2 million cases of COVID-19, far more than anywhere else in the world. This comes just 5 months after the first reports of the virus reaching America. New cases have been declining in places like Washington State, New York, and Michigan, which had higher infection rates at first, but they're rising in a new wave. 9 states, including Oregon and neighboring Nevada, are recording rising numbers of cases since just before Memorial Day, when many states begin to ease up on stay-at-home restrictions. The spike in new cases caused the U.S. stock market to take a nosedive today. The Dow plunged 1,800 points, its worst day since March. Around the world, more than 7.4 million people have documented cases of COVID-19, and it's linked to more than 416,000 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. The state of Oregon logged an unusually high 178 new cases of the virus today and 2 new deaths. This brings the total to more than 5,200 people in Oregon testing positive for COVID-19, which is linked to 171 deaths in the state. So far, 864 people in Oregon had to be hospitalized because of the infection. It's affected at least 24 Oregon workplaces. This all comes as Oregon Governor Kate Brown says she's worried about COVID-19 spreading among protesters who've been gathering both to oppose Oregon's stay-at-home order and also the thousands gathering every night to protest police brutality. She encourages protesters to practice their First Amendment rights safely, wearing face coverings, maintaining social distance, and using hand sanitizer. Multnomah County has been making progress to become the last county in the state to enter phase one of reopening. But health officials also say there have been areas where the county is still falling short, especially when it comes to benchmarks that disproportionately affect people of color. The county's public health director, Rachel Banks, told county commissioners that there are enough hospital beds to handle more cases, but hospitalizations started to increase on May 31st. Leaders from communities of color are asking the county to release more information. At first, most of those testing positive for the virus in Multnomah County were white, but ever since April, the numbers have been increasing in communities of color. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Two Portland city commissioners are showing they are heeding the concerns of tens of thousands of protesters in the city. This afternoon at a city budget hearing, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty planned to introduce amendments to the city's budget to cut the police department budget by about $15.6 million. Her proposal would cut the Gun Violence Reduction Team, Transit Police, and School Resource Officer program, which Mayor Wheeler has already announced that he was going to end. Previously, Wheeler also said he would include disbanding the Gun Violence Reduction Team and instituting a ban on chokeholds as part of police reform. Another police cut would remove cannabis recreational marijuana tax funds from the police budget. Hardesty is proposing to move more money into programs like the Portland Street Response, Black Youth Development, the Tribal Liaison, and the Participatory Budgeting with the Houseless Community. In all, she's proposing cuts of 107 jobs at the Portland Police Bureau. She says she does not want to eliminate the Police Bureau, but wants to see it transformed by hiring and training officers differently. And Portland City Commissioner Chloe Daly is proposing a cut of more than $4.6 million and eliminating 50 vacant full-time positions from the Portland Police Bureau. Both commissioners are proposing bigger cuts than Mayor Ted Wheeler. Wheeler announced this week that he wants to redirect $12 million to programs that benefit communities of color. The Portland Police Bureau currently costs $244 million a year. A federal judge in Portland has issued a two-week restraining order, which partly grants Don't Shoot Portland's request to ban police from using tear gas. U.S. District Judge Marco Hernandez says police can use chemical weapons against protesters only as a life-saving measure. Hernandez found Don't Shoot Portland's claim that police used tear gas against peaceful protesters credible. He wrote, quote, "In some of these instances, there is no evidence of any provocation. In others, individuals appear to have shaken fences and thrown water bottles and fireworks at police. Either way, there is no dispute that plaintiffs engaged in only peaceful and non-destructive protest. There is no record of criminal activity on the part of plaintiffs. To the contrary, there is evidence that some protesters were confronted with tear gas while trying to follow police orders and leave demonstrations," end quote. Portland's African American Leadership Forum and Unite Oregon are calling for a total ban on tear gas. Nine members of the Oregon legislature are promoting bills that would tighten the accountability of police in the state after the death of George Floyd and the protests in Portland and around the world. The People of Color Caucus is trying to get two bills passed during a possible special session of the legislature this year and another measure next year. One measure is a new version of Portland State Senator Lou Frederick's bill, number 1567, which would rule that if an arbitrator concludes there was police misconduct, the arbitrator can't lessen disciplinary action taken by the agency against the officer based on the misconduct. The bill passed in the Senate unanimously, but died in the House without a vote after the 2020 session ended on March 5th. Another measure would require the Oregon Department of Justice and an elected attorney general to investigate deaths or serious injuries when police use deadly force. Those investigations are now conducted by police and district attorneys in Oregon's 36 counties. The third measure would direct the House Judiciary Committee to convene a bipartisan work group to look at Oregon's law governing police use of deadly force when making an arrest or preventing an escape. House Speaker Tina Kotek released a statement saying, quote, "Oregon has an opportunity to prevent abuses that have gone on far too long. We must rise to the challenge of this moment and make real change to create a safer and supportive community for all Oregonians." And the new Senate Majority Leader, Rob Wagner, said on Facebook, quote, "As elected leaders, we have the power to change the way our laws uphold institutional racism and systems of oppression, and we cannot wait any longer to take action. The People of Color Caucus has put forth policy proposals to improve police accountability and act against injustice." Chuck Lavelle, the Portland Police Bureau's new black chief of police, was sworn in this morning. He spoke about some changes he'd like to see within the Bureau during a media briefing. First, he said the Bureau and the city needs to listen to the community to come together on decisions that will benefit all sides. Lavelle said he supports community policing and added, quote, "It's time for it to come back in a way where people in their communities know their police officer, where an officer has accountability to a community because they have to show up every day." After Mayor Ted Wheeler announced on Tuesday that the city's gun violence reduction team would be eliminated, Lavelle said today that officers within the team will be reassigned in the Bureau. Lavelle also said he expects to have an in-depth conversation with Wheeler soon. He commented on the future of funding the police in Portland, saying he thinks communities need policing, and that instead of defunding police departments, people should focus on, quote, "police service that is just and meets the needs and expectations of the community." A redeveloped park in northeast Portland will be renamed, and it will honor a prominent black woman for the first time in Portland's history. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more on the story.
Formerly known as Lynchview Park, the 8-acre site at Southeast 167th Avenue and Market Street will now be known as Verdell Burdine Rutherford Park, city officials announced Wednesday. The park got its original name from Patrick Lynch, who donated a piece of land to the Centennial School District in the late 1800s. Verdell Rutherford's family moved to Oregon after she was born in Oklahoma in 1913 and lived in the state until her death in 2001. Verdell married Otto Rutherford in 1936 and settled in Portland. Otto served as president of the Oregon chapter of the NAACP for 2 terms and Burdine as a secretary for many years. According to Portland Parks and Recreation, as part of the NAACP, she helped pass the Public Accommodations Bill, which in 1953 outlawed discrimination in public places on the basis of race, religion, or national origin. She was a member of the Bethel AME Church and the Culture Club, a group that was an important network for black women in Portland. She also collected newspapers, letters, photographs, and other records that document the black community in Portland over the span of 60 years. In 2011, Verdell's daughter, Charlotte, gifted these records to the Portland State University Library Special Collections and the Black Studies Department so it could be accessible for academic and public use. A new playground and picnic shelter and paved pathways have recently been added to the park with funding from the 2014 Parks Replacement Bond and Fees, according to Willamette Week. A community celebration for the park's renaming is reportedly being planned for a later date. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
Instead of protesters, President Trump is calling demonstrators in Washington state domestic terrorists. On Twitter, Trump blasted Washington Governor Jay Inslee and Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, threatening federal action if they don't quote-unquote take back the city of Seattle. Trump called Inslee a radical left governor and said he and the mayor of Seattle are, quote, being taunted and played. His Twitter rant continued, quote, "Take back your city now. If you don't do it, I will. This is not a game. These ugly anarchists must be stooped immediately. Move fast." Inslee hit back, tweeting, quote, "A man who is totally incapable of governing should stay out of Washington state's business. Stoop tweeting," he wrote, making fun of Trump's misspelling of the word stopped. Mayor Durkin wrote, quote, "Make us all safe. Go back to your bunker," referring to when Trump rushed into a safe room in the White House during protests over the May 25th death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. After days of clashes with protesters outside the Seattle Police's East Precinct, authorities backed down this week, removing barricades and boarding up the building. Since then, protesters moved in, calling the area the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, where police are forbidden, food is free, and documentaries are screened at night. Some protesters say it's a first step towards their goal of defunding the police and ending racial injustice. Workers in Oregon are among the many who've gotten brief pay bumps called hero pay or hazard pay while laboring on the front lines of grocery stores during the COVID crisis. Now, across the country, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union estimates that more than 9,000 grocery store workers have been infected with the virus. As Diane Bernard reports, the union's protests are escalating a push for grocery chains to extend hazard pay.
Yesterday, Kroger's union workers in West Virginia and Virginia staged a car caravan demonstration to urge the grocery giant to reinstate hazard pay while the pandemic continues. The supermarket chain quietly ended its $2 an hour hero pay last month and replaced it with a one-time thank you bonus, which will be paid out next week. Bill Caldwell has been working at a West Virginia Kroger for 44 years. He thinks it's careless for the company to stop bonuses and extra pay while he has taken on major risks and a heavier workload during the pandemic. He says his store was very late in protecting employees against the virus.
After about a month, then they started to take our temperature, but the tools they used didn't do very well. And then we started wearing masks probably just 3 weeks ago.
In a statement, a Kroger spokeswoman said the company has invested more than $800 million to reward and safeguard associates since March. She added that they will continue to safeguard employees while running a sustainable business that provides steady employment for over 500,000 associates. But Jonathan Williams, a spokesman for United Food and Commercial Workers Local 400, which represents Kroger's Mid-Atlantic Union members, says the chain could easily afford to continue the $2 an hour extra pay for essential workers. He points out that the pandemic is not over and the company has reaped in record profits while it's gone on.
No surprise to us that Kroger is raking in cash right now from their sales, but unfortunately, they're not sharing that success with the members who are making it possible and who indeed are risking their lives and the lives of their families in order to make this success possible.
He says the UFCW estimated 65 grocery store workers died of coronavirus as of last month, and more than 9,000 were infected. He expects that number to be much higher now. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on defunding the Portland Police. At 6, we'll hear Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 58. Tomorrow's weather, showers likely in the morning, and a high of 64. Today in history, the state in 1963 was an important one for the American Civil Rights Movement. It was the date that Governor George Wallace of Alabama defiantly stood at the door of the University of Alabama, trying to block two black students, Vivian Malone and James Hood, from attending the school. The quote of the day is from Vivian Malone Jones, who said, quote, "I didn't feel I should sneak in. I didn't feel I should go around the back door. If Wallace were standing in the door, I had every right in the world to face him and to go to school." She went on to become the first black person to graduate from the University of Alabama. Vice President Joe Biden joined the NAACP for a virtual town hall as Republican lawmakers worked on a Senate police reform bill. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
If you're going to put your corporate logo behind Black Lives Matter, then you better put your logo and your influence behind the idea that Black votes matter. Every election cycle, for years, as you've heard before, we see the tactics which suppress our votes.
Wendy Fields leads Democracy Initiative, a coalition of small D Democratic reform groups. Fields, who is black, says people are fed up with the long lines, malfunctioning machines, lost absentee ballots, and other voting problems that make it harder for every citizen to vote, and especially black and indigenous people of color, people experiencing homelessness, and people with disabilities. Georgia was the latest to demonstrate these forms of voter suppression, but Fields says Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Wisconsin showed the same pattern.
We're fed up for not being counted. We're fed up for not being heard. We're fed up with our lives being threatened. The knee of racism is going to be on our neck again in November. if people are turned away at the polls, if all the ballots aren't counted.
George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, testified before Congress yesterday, encouraging lawmakers to pass police reforms now. Hours later, former Vice President Joe Biden joined the NAACP for a virtual town hall.
We know there have been institutional racism in this country before we were a country. It didn't start with Donald Trump. It's not going to end with Donald Trump. But right now, we have an enormous opportunity to make significant change.
Recent polling from Civics shows support for Black Lives Matter up 10 points in the last 2 weeks. That's more change than in the last 2 years. While Republican lawmakers refrain from criticizing House Democrats' police reform bill, the Justice and Policing Act, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tasked the Senate's only Black Republican, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, with drafting a GOP version.
If they want to try, I want to listen, because they are going to have to do something.
Democratic Ohio Representative Marsha Fudge hopes the Senate's bill will also ban chokeholds and no-knock forced entries in drug cases, increase accountability, and condition funding on anti-discrimination policies, among other measures.
Let me just say this, Ed. We have them on the run, quite frankly. Right now, the president has Tim Scott trying to come up with a bill. And so they know they must do something.
After polling that shows Biden in a better position to beat an incumbent than any challenger since Bill Clinton in 1992, Trump announced his first big rallies since the new coronavirus lockdown, next week in Tulsa, Oklahoma, then Arizona, North Carolina, and Florida. He also became the first president to threaten to sue CNN for one of its standard polls. The outlet stands by the survey and says they've never before been threatened by a political campaign over polling results. And despite reports that the Republican National Convention would be moving to Jacksonville, Florida, the RNC voted last night to pare down and keep it in Charlotte, North Carolina. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Amazon announced Wednesday it's banning police use of its facial recognition software for 1 year. The company said it would like governments to implement stronger regulations for a more ethical use of facial recognition technology, and said in a statement, quote, "We hope this one-year moratorium might give Congress enough time to implement appropriate rules, and we stand ready to help if requested." Amazon's recognition software is used by organizations that work with law enforcement to advocate for victims of crime, according to the company's web services. Washington County, Oregon's sheriff's office was the first in the country to use it for law enforcement. When the software was launched in 2016, it was described by Amazon as, quote, "a service that makes it easy to add image analysis to your work applications and to detect objects, scenes, and faces in images." Joy Bwalamwini, the founder of the Algorithmic Justice League, testified for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology last year about research showing that facial recognition software may hold racial and gender bias. It was better able to recognize white men's faces than women's and people of color. Representative Jimmy Gomez, who serves on the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, said the committee has been having issues getting data and information from Amazon that would make it easier to implement reform. According to Gomez, the committee has held numerous hearings on the use of facial recognition software and is hopeful Congress will pass a bill this year. Suppression of Native American votes is becoming more of a focus as the election draws nearer. To learn more, we go to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Native American Rights Fund has outlined ways to avoid potential voting barriers for Native Americans as states prep for the 2020 election and consider safety options amid the COVID-19 pandemic, Christine Trudeau reports.
Any move to an entirely vote-by-mail system for the 2020 elections would be a big problem for voters in Indian country, with the potential to disenfranchise many. That's according to Jacqueline DeLeon, a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund and a co-author of NARF's recent voting rights report detailing multiple voting barriers that Native Americans face today. DeLeon says inconsistent mail service in Indian country is why vote-by-mail alone isn't a good option.
The way mail works in Indian country is, if you're getting mail at all, it's likely going to be at a post office through a post office box that you might be sharing with, you know, 15 other people. I mean, that was not unheard of to hear just a lot of people sharing one post office box.
Anne says De Leon, in the process of picking up and distributing that mail from a shared P.O. box, it's not uncommon for items to get misplaced or delivered to the wrong person, making the wait to get mail delivered longer, sometimes taking up to a month. In light of this and other challenges facing voters on access and safety, NARF has put out a guide advocating specific changes that could help many Native voters across Indian Country, like maintaining in-person voting.
An in-person voting option can be controlled. You can have, you know, PPE, sanitation practices. You can do curbside voting. You can utilize Native community members and say that, you know, they're the ones that are running the polls to, like, you know, reduce the introduction of outside people. And that kind of controlled environment is better than sort of this, you know, hodgepodge way that people get mail in Indian Country now.
NARF's other recommendations include increasing the number of ballot collection boxes available through Election Day, that tribes be able to designate buildings to pick up and drop off ballots, that early voting hours for elderly and the immunocompromised are available, and creating a robust educational outreach campaign to tribal communities on any updates to the voting process. You can find out more about these recommendations at narf.org/vote-by-mail. I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is a collaboration with National Native News and the Solutions Journalism Network. A crowd of people watched as a statue of Christopher Columbus was taken down with a rope Wednesday in St. Paul by some members of the Native community. In a live stream by television station KSTP, people cheered as the statue hit the ground. Hand drum song and round dance followed as law enforcement watched nearby, then cleared the area holding batons, waiting for its removal. The move at Minnesota's Capitol follows the beheading of a Columbus statue in Boston and Confederate statues in different parts of the country torn down after the recent police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Floyd's death has sparked protests across the country over police violence against people of color and reignited the debate over controversial monuments. Columbus is a symbol of genocide to Native Americans, as people see taking down memorials in his honor and dropping the Columbus Day holiday as part of the healing process. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute kicked off Celebration 2020 virtually Wednesday. The large in-person gathering in Southeast Alaska is postponed this year due to COVID-19. The four-day broadcast on YouTube and public television features dance, art, storytelling, and other events. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The momentum for micro-credentials is building as workers seek new skills to be competitive in the job market. As Eric Tegedoff reports, earning certificates can come at a quarter of the cost of long-term bachelor's programs.
There isn't much folks can do with degrees they don't finish, but another path to higher education is gaining steam as people out of work from the pandemic look to advance their careers. Micro-credentials, or stackable credentials, allow folks to break up their educational goals and move them closer. They gain skills in the form of certificates to put on their resume and can even add them up to a bachelor's degree. John Marcus wrote about this for the Hechinger Report.
They can't wait 6 years. They need to get a workplace-ready credential really fast. And so micro-credentials are getting a huge bump in momentum from people who need education, and they need education really quickly.
Marcus says another advantage to micro-credentials is that they come at a quarter of the cost. But he adds that employers' reactions to certifications, often achieved online, have been mixed. This isn't a new concept. Patrick Crane is Director of Community Colleges and Workforce Development for the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. He says community colleges in the state have embedded certificates in associate degree programs since 2007. But he says it's still hard to get the traditional notion of college out of people's heads.
Getting the idea that people have of college to line up with current reality so that they do feel like college is for them, that there are opportunities beyond a traditional four-year degree, is something that we spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about.
Karen Hummelbaugh is director of the Office of Workforce Investments, also in the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. She says stackable credentials are important for healthcare workers looking to advance their careers. It's also a manageable way for people to work towards other careers.
To be able to, over time, work themselves into another career versus feeling like they have a mountain they have to climb with a two-year degree or something like that. They can actually take these smaller steps that seem less insurmountable.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 11th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Melissa Hood and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Eric Tegedoff, and Diane Bernard. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
Okay, great. One last thing I like to always mention to folks before I interview them: if you ever come across something that you want to be off the record, please let me know before you say it, if you can. Okay. Yes, thank you. Okay. First, if you don't mind, Casey, can you go into a little bit of background for folks who aren't super familiar with Unite Oregon about the work that your organization does with people of color, low-income Oregonians, and refugees and immigrants?
Yes, so Unite Oregon is a social, racial, economic justice organization. We've been around, if you add the years between the two organizations, we merged with Southern Political Cultural Organizing and Oregon Action. We have about history of close to 50 years of community organizing and racial justice and immigrant refugee rights. Currently, we have three offices. One, the main office is in Portland, and we have an office in Washington County, and we have an office in Rogue Valley, Medford, Oregon. Those are the three offices. And we have a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multiracial, multilingual staff members who are actually doing the work. And our mission is really to unite urban and rural community for economic and racial justice. That's what we do. And we have quite a few programs that really works with the people of color, immigrant refugees, and low income. And one of the programs I usually highlight is about our leadership development program, which really trainees emerging immigrant refugee leaders to a year-long program in Portland that helps to gain skills necessary to push their community issues forward. And Rogue Valley, we work with the youth and we work with the train other emerging leaders to get the work, get involved in the organizations and do the work that is necessary to be done. So that's kind of in general overall what we do, but most important takeaway point is that we are a grassroots organization and we want our community members who are aligned with our values and our mission to get involved in the organization. So staff is facilitators, they're organizers, but the most important thing we would like to see happen is that the community members take action and get involved in the organization's day-to-day activities and programs.
That's great. And as a grassroots organization that works so closely with the community and specifically with people of color, immigrants, refugees, and low-income Oregonians, as you just stated, in so many different ways, can you talk about why it's that important for Unite Oregon to, as you've made it public, to ask for City Council to defund the Portland Police Bureau?
I think this is really a question that's very complex, and so I will start with, first of all, the history of United States policing and where we have the police history, police departments across the country that's historically connected to the slavery and white supremacy. So that's really the history. And then, of course, you know, throughout the years and decades of our policing targeting people of color, immigrant refugees, and low-income communities to repressive tactics and killings. And it has been really, really profoundly impacted in the community that we work with. And secondly, it's the structures that we have, right? So we have police departments that really historically are not accountable to anyone, including, I will say, the elected officials, who has power that is unchallenged. They are able to kill people, detain people, tear gas protesters, and there's no accountability. There's no one to account. They are above the law. And so that's another issue. And then generally then, you know, community organizations like ours have been decades advocating for change and asking the police department to be reformed, to be held accountable. And it went to a deep ears. So what you have right now is the breath of this storm where, you know, community has been really been impacted by the police brutality and police targeting their community, especially the low-income and people of color, and particularly the Black community. So the combination of those, the structural issues, the lack of accountability, and then, of course, their share of the budget that they take out from the programs they did from the city, which is, you know, for the past decades, the police department, the police bureau's budget really dramatically decreased. We spend the police department more than we spend in our housing and homelessness issues. We spend actually more than 7 times amount of money that we spend on housing. We spend more money than parks and recreation. We spend more money on the fire department and bureau fire department. Those are really critical services, and homelessness and housing issues. Those are critical services that if we take the money and put it into those services can help the community and really elevate some of the painful, historically, unjust that we have done to our communities, particularly Black and Brown community. So those are some of the larger contexts that why we ask the funding the police of an amount of $50 million. This is the beginning, and I actually want to emphasize this is actually a very, very small amount compared to the resources that they're already getting. So we're not actually, as I said, this is the beginning. This is not all we're asking. We want a systemic change. We want a policy change. We want to be held accountable to our police departments and our law enforcement folks. So this is not a big ask, actually, as I said. So I will really stop there and see if you have additional questions. But overall, what we're asking is that we wanted this resource to go to the programs that serve the community that we it has been historically impacted, particularly the Black and Brown community. So that's kind of really where we're standing for. And I think, again, the moment is right, and I think we're asking the leadership of the city and the mayor and the commissioners to meet the demands of the community that ask these small changes that we're asking.
Thank you for explaining that. And you're saying how you want a positive change. You explained, thank you for explaining briefly as you could about the history of police in America and how that's impacted the Portland community, specifically communities of color. And you mentioned how $50 million in the grand scheme of things is a small portion of at least $1 billion general funds pool of money. And you spoke about the different ways this money could be used instead of being given to the police. Can you go into how reinvesting that money into the community, specifically community members that have been largely ignored since Portland's founding, can you talk about why that's so important?
I think it's important, first of all, because, again, as I said earlier, majority of the calls of the police calls that the 911 dispatchers receive and police respond to is non-criminal related activity, meaning that there is no criminal activity going on. What it really is about livability issues. Someone calling for a houseless person for the police and for someone who has a mental health crisis. Those are basics of almost most of the calls that they receive. That is a waste of time, resources, and energy. Those police officers generally tend to escalate the situation and arrest or detain folks who are houseless. As Argonia reported, 52% of the arrests that has been made last year was made by what were the homeless and houseless community. These folks are not trained to de-escalate. They're not trained to be social workers. They're not trained to be kind and humane to people who are struggling. They are trained to oppress and really escalate the situations that they're dealing with. So what we are asking is that this money to be reallocated and reinvest the community so we can provide parental assistance, we can provide mental health programs, we can provide youth leadership development programs, we can provide potentially, you know, mortgage assistance, particularly the Black and brown community which been impacted. We can provide economic investment support, particularly the small businesses that are owned by Black and brown community. So we are not short of ideas. There are so many ways that we can invest this money. And PALF and United Organization are actually asking that there is a special money to be set aside, and those money should be decided by the community who have been impacted, how to invest back to the community. Andrew, do you want to add anything?
I would just say that I would recommend folks take a look at PALF's People's Plan that was developed several years ago, because it's got a number of really strong, actionable recommendations to lift up the health and well-being, particularly of Black Portlanders. And it calls for things like, you know, investing funding in culturally specific mental health care healing centers, right, that can really meet folks' needs in a community-centered context. Using funding to improve neighborhood access to healthy food and safe recreation, right, a really broad agenda for health and well-being, and that's really what we're calling for, right, reinvesting this money that we have spent on over-policing and policing in general, right, because I think we take the stance that we are working towards the abolition of police. Really wanting to invest that funding in things that matter, like the health and well-being of partners who have been targeted by police violence.
And Andrew, you mentioned the word abolition of police. For many folks who are listening, whether they are in support of this mission or in opposition, they're going to hang on to that word, I believe. Is the ultimate goal to disband the Portland Police Bureau, as other cities are calling for throughout the nation?
That's a great question, and what I would say is that is the goal that we have identified with PALF and Unite, right? And as Casey said, this $50 million demand is really the start. That is our demand for this current budget cycle. I think as organizations, we don't think that, you know, it's just a matter of passing an ordinance to abolish the Portland Police Bureau, right? That we need to do some really intentional work in the community to lift up community safety, to really have the communities develop a vision for how we can keep ourselves safe in a world without police. But I do think that that's the world that we are envisioning and imagining, and that's what we're working towards.
So let me add to that. The question of abolition of the police, it's for me as a, you know, former refugee, it's a very complex one. And what I would like to say is that, you know, if we need to have something in place to get there. You know, in my understanding of my country, where I came from, you know, when you know, we have the institution is systems have been dismantled, or you know, because of the civil war, we have to create some sort of a response to how safety and the community has been taken care of it. So my suggestion is that, you know, this is a long goal, term goal, but we want to have to also envision a place where, you know, our community is safe and harmonious, and we're able to create a system that's more accountable to the community that they serve. So that's kind of really, for me, the nuance that I want to add to the complexity of the issue. But at the end of the day, I do believe that Portland Police, and in general, it's not a formidable entity. So I think at some point that we have to really decide what kind of a safety mechanisms that we want to have in place and what kind of a law enforcement force that we're going to have, if we have, we want to have, and what even that means, what it looks like. I wouldn't even call the law enforcement, but I think if we have a, we want to create a peace agent that is more responsible to the support and the well-being of the community, we have to envision us also as a community what that's going to look like. So that's kind of the complexity of the issue.
Thank you for explaining that and taking the time to do so, both of you. I want to get into two things, but before I get into what you just mentioned about how you believe the Portland Police Bureau is not reformable, I'd like you to first, if you can, explain what how you envision a different society in Portland that doesn't largely rely on the police to do, as you mentioned earlier, to deal with issues of the homeless community, whether that's health-related, mental health issues, or when, as we know, the sweeps happen. Can you talk about what a different Portland community would look like without relying so heavily on the police department for so many different things?
So I think for me, the first of all, you know, we have to look into the structures of the society, right? So I think a few minutes, I'm going to take a little bit more about kind of explaining where we are as a society. Right now, our society is extremely, as you know, is divided in terms of the economic disparities and racial and ethnic disparities. If you really want to have a healthy, well-structured society, you have to also address the systematic and the cultural white supremacy that we have in this country. Without that changing the people's mindset, how safety and community cohesion should evolve, it boils down to really dismantling white supremacy in this country, and then dismantling the structural economic system is that really doesn't serve and support the well-being of majority of the society. So there has to be societal change that needs to happen in order to create a space where we can envision a just and harmonious community society that really takes care of each other and supports each other. Without that really transformative societal change, I think we're going to have a long history of continuously of injustices that we are seeing. So that's the first place. But, you know, are we going to see this in my lifetime or your lifetime? I honestly don't know. This is a really complex issue. But we have to envision and dream about that kind of a vision, a long-term vision. And only the way that it can happen is that when we build a movement that is really based in the community that they are in, that really can create the change and systematic change that necessary to take place in order to get where we need to be getting our society. So it's a very difficult and complex answer, but again, they're all in trend. So what I'm fearful for me is like, you know, that if we have a white supremacy movement in this country and this state and this community, if they are as they did in the last year and this year, and they still support them, and they are armed and well armed, as a black man, you know, where's my safety comes up? You know, who am I lying to my safety? If these folks of the militia who are unaccountable to anybody, who can kill anybody if they decide, where's my safety and who am I going to keep me safe? So until that, really, those are the questions that as a black African refugee man, I have to struggle and have to think about my safety as a person. And that's really individual place, but societal place, those are the thing, context and the new ones that we have to think about. And I want to invite Andrew to be able to add. So I'm sorry it took me a long time to explain, but okay, that's
thank
kind
you.
Of,
yes.
Yeah.
Andrew, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to answer that question. I would start thinking about all of the different ways that we can empower police to deal with, I even hesitate to call them social problems, right? But let's, you know, for lack of a better phrase, mm-hmm. right? We have school resource officers, and the idea there is apparently if, you know, a student is having challenges in school, apparently you need an armed police officer there, right? That seems wrong to me.
In that same way, right, you know, what students are going to need is counseling. They're going to need trauma-informed care. They're going to need folks who can really invest in their education and their future. And you can't do that as well if you are paying for police officers. And I actually just learned a quite shocking thing the other day, which is that the Peterson School District, for example, has school resource police officers in many of its schools, from elementary on up. Very few of the schools have nurses. That to me is backwards, right? We are ceding different things to the police that we should. And it's the same as Casey mentioned with the treatment of our unhoused community, right? The solution, in as much as, you know, I hate to talk about a solution, right? But the challenge is that there's, you know, not enough housing that's been made available to folks who can't afford it, right? I'm not going to say that there's not enough housing because there's a lot of vacant housing in Portland. But the solution to, you know, any challenges related to houselessness are building housing, giving folks a place to live, giving them the ability to thrive with as few barriers as possible. But instead, we've turned that over to police, to sweep camps, to destroy people's property, to destroy people's communities that they have eked out of a really brutal system. And I think that those are just a couple of examples of where we have really turned to police. We've turned to this very violent, very carceral model that ultimately does result in people being placed in prison, locked in cages, to address issues that have absolutely nothing to do with the presence of armed paramilitaries, right? We're addressing so many different issues through police, and we need to stop that. And so my vision for the world to come involves that. It involves really addressing, as Casey said, the root causes of any issues that we are seeing in the community, right? If there are folks who don't have housing, we give them housing. If there are folks who are struggling with crisis in their mental or emotional health, we make sure that they have, you know, supportive services that are available to them and meet them where they're at, right? Culturally competent services and what have you. We don't invest that money, or we shouldn't invest that money, in armed paramilitaries who, as we see, ultimately just target folks for arrest, citation, and imprisonment, and in some cases, maim and murder us.
Real quick, just playing devil's advocate for those who I know will want to ask this question. How do you keep those other organizations that would take on the responsibility that police are currently doing, and some might argue, many might argue, are failing at, how do you keep those entities accountable and not doing the same harm, just under a different name, than the police?
That's a really good question, and this is an opportunity for me to be really clear that the vision that I have for policing moving forward is not give all of police powers to another slightly friendlier agency that looks and acts very much the same, right? I don't think the solution, as Casey said, is reform to make police somehow slightly less violent, if that were possible. But what I would say is that that's a huge question that I think we dig into a lot around school districts, cities, counties, metro, TriMet, other agencies. And I think, you know, this is connected to what Casey is saying around the need to transform society in ways that promote community safety, in ways that, you know, move beyond policing. And to me, it involves smaller scale communities to which, you know, folks are accountable. I think that that's one of the most important things for promoting safety, is making sure that communities are accountable to one another. And in the case of school districts, I think, you know, or cities or counties or what have you, there's a lot of different things we're going to need to look at to honestly improve direct democracy in Portland, improve the accountability of folks to the grassroots, and improve the accountability each of us have to one another as Portlanders.
Thank you for explaining that, and I appreciate you answering the question. I know it's very complex and it's much further down the road. Can you explain, either Andrew or Casey, the word reformable is used earlier, in that Casey, I believe you said that you don't believe that the Portland Police Bureau is capable of being reformable. Can either or both of you get into why you believe that and why we can't just in some ways fix the police, whether it involves funding or not funding them?
I want to quickly jump in, then I'll invite Andrew. So first of all, there is a history, right? So the community that we work with, and particular organizations who are focused on criminal justice reform and police reform, decades and decades and decades have been asking demands to the police bureau be held accountable and be transformed to a more accountable agency. What we have seen is that they've persisted, and elected officials who are supposed to be in control and the law enforcement and our police department has resisted any meaningful change. And to the contrary, we have seen more and more police militarized police department where, you know, they actually became even more military force rather than a police force. So we, although we were demanding change, and we've seen the problem for decades, the instead of change and accountability really became more and more going to the opposite direction. And not only that, they forcefully rejected any call to even have a basic meaningful accountability discussions. And then the second piece is that what we said, I do believe historically the agency is really rooted in the white supremacy model. So, you know, you just can't have that. If your basic infrastructure, if you live in a house and your foundation is not solid and it's not able to uphold the house that you're living in, that house is going to collapse and it's not going to be a livable place. What we have the Border and Police Bureau is an organization that is structurally fundamentally important, and so we, you know, as I said earlier, we demanded change for many years, and again it really went in the opposite direction rather than being accountable. And they also, in addition, finally, as I said earlier, they also forcefully go against any change that's hold them accountable. So those are some of the basic elements that I'm raising when I say that I do believe that Border and Police is not formable. Those are some of the ingredients that makes difficult to do any meaningful reform.
Thank you. Andrew, did you want to add anything?
I'll just add quickly. I think I just want to echo Casey there that you can only reform a system if the foundation is solid. And as Casey, you know, explained earlier, the foundation of all policing in America is rooted in slavery, is rooted in racism, is rooted in white supremacy, and you fundamentally cannot divorce that from policing. And then when we look at Portland, we have to acknowledge that reforms have been tried for decades and decades and decades. Organizers that I'm working with have been banging their head against the wall for longer than I've been alive, trying to fight for justice in Portland, and it's not working. And you know that because we can list off the names of people from our community who have been killed by Portland police, right? Aaron Campbell, Deontay Keller, Keaton Otis, Patrick Timmons, Andre Gladen, James Jahar Perez, Kendra James, and so many more. They are not with us because reform doesn't work, right? And after every one of those very public deaths, after every one of those very public police murders, there is a wave of reform, a wave of good energy, and then we return to business as usual. And so I think in practice, the failure of any of those reforms to meaningfully hold Portland police accountable, combined with the fact that policing is racist at its core, means that you just cannot reform the Portland police.
Thank you for explaining that. And playing devil's advocate, no one can ignore exactly what you just said, that there are still going to be folks who will say, we can't completely remove the police because of issues of murder and serious egregious cases like murder and rape and other types of violent acts. Can you talk to those folks? What would you say to those folks who fear completely removing the police force?
I think for me, let me be very clear. We do want to have a community safety plan. No one is saying that, you know, as I started earlier, we're not saying that completely we will have, in many ways, what you can call libertarian world where everybody is living in their own way and being responsible on their safety. There has to be some social contract mechanism that we have to build in for community safety plan. Personally, as someone who came from a war-torn country, I do believe that there has to be some sort of a safety mechanism. But I think in order to get there, that kind of a way where we talk about clearance system is that's different than what we have right now, the ingredients, again, has to be there. So I want to invite those folks really to think about strategy to be visionaries and really, first of all, agree with us that the fundamental societal contract has to change, and we have to create economic systems change in this country. We have to create social and non-societal norms where, you know, we have to figure out how we treat each other, how we deal with each other individually. And we have to elevate some of the painful historical wrongs that has been done to Black and brown communities. Those are some of the ingredients that has to be in place before we think about whether we want to have what kind of a law enforcement, what kind of a, system that we're going to replace what we have right now. What we know of is that what we have right now, it's not working and it's not going to work. But again, in order to get what different systems, we have to be able to also create the mechanism and the space and to have that deeper discussion and have the ingredients in place, both economic justice, racial justice, and overall societal interconnectedness.
So to be clear and to clarify, there has to be space for a new way of doing things rather than just trying to push for a better, more idealistic society.
I'm not advocating for libertarian space. I don't want to so we are interconnected society, we are interconnected community, we are a community that really has to have some sort of a social contract. And so in order to do that, we need to have some sort of a system in place to make sure that the safety of the most vulnerable populations have been taken care of. What that system looks like is completely has to be different than what we have. But what that system looks like, we're not even there yet even to have the vision that we have to really think about what I said earlier, what's the ingredients to even have that kind of a conversation and visioning process.
Gotcha. Thank you for clarifying that. Going back to defunding, we can...
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times.